absorbed by the swirling silver spheres. Through the broken window, the setting sun's light fell on the model, and the flying spheres intermittently reflected the light onto the rebel commander, like sparks from a bonfire.
No, I've only just started,
Yeah said softly. 22. Red Coast 5. Since she had entered Red Coast Base, Yawinsia had never thought of leaving. After she learned the real purpose of the Red Coast Project, top secret information that even many mid-level cadres at the base didn't know, she cut off her spiritual connection to the outside world and devoted herself to her work. Thereafter, she became even more deeply embedded in the technical core of Red Coast, and began to take on more important research topics. Commissar Lei never forgot that it was Chief Yang who first trusted Ye, but Lei was happy to assign important topics to her. Given Ye's status, she had no rights to the results of her research, and Lei, who had studied astrophysics, was a political officer who was also an intellectual, rare at the time. Thus, he could take credit for all of Ye's research results and papers, and cast himself as an exemplary political officer with both technical acumen and revolutionary zeal. The Red Coast Project had initially requisitioned Ye because of a paper on an attempted mathematical model of the sun she had published in the Journal of Astrophysics as a graduate student. Compared to the Earth, the sun was a far simpler physical system, made almost entirely of hydrogen and helium. Though its physical processes were violent, they were relatively straightforward, only fusing hydrogen into helium. Thus, it was likely that a mathematical model of the sun could describe it rather precisely. The paper was basic, but Lei and Yang saw in it a hope for a solution to a technical difficulty faced by the Red Coast monitoring system. Solar outages, a common problem in satellite communications, had always plagued the Red Coast monitoring operations. When the Earth, an artificial satellite, and the sun are in a straight line, the line of sight from the ground-based antenna to the satellite will have the sun as its background. The sun is a giant source of electromagnetic radiation, and, as a result, satellite transmissions to the ground will be overwhelmed by interference from the solar radiation. This problem could not be completely solved, even in the 21st century. The interference that Red Coast had to deal with was similar, but the source of interference, the sun, was between the source of the transmission, outer space, and the ground-based receiver. Compared to communication satellites, the solar outages suffered by Red Coast were more frequent and more severe. Red Coast Base, as constructed, was also much more modest than its original design, such that the transmission and monitoring systems shared the same antenna. This made the times available for monitoring even more precious, and solar outages even more of a problem. Lei and Yang's idea for eliminating interference was very simple. Ascertain the frequency spectrum and characteristics of solar radiation in the monitored range, and then filter it out digitally. Both of them were technical, and at that time, when the ignorant often led the knowledgeable, that was a rare bit of fortune. But Yang wasn't a specialist in astrophysics, and Lei had taken the path of becoming a political officer, which prevented him from accruing in-depth technical know-how. In reality, electromagnetic radiation from the sun is only stable within the limited range from near ultraviolet to mid-infrared, including visible light. In other ranges, the radiation is quite volatile and unpredictable. To set the right expectations, Ye made it clear in her first research report that during periods of intense solar activity, sunspots, solar flares, coronal mass ejections, and so on, it was impossible to eliminate solar interference. Thus, her research target was limited to radiation within the frequency ranges monitored by Red Coast during periods of normal solar activity. Research conditions at the base weren't too bad. The library could obtain foreign language materials related to the topic, including timely European and American academic journals. In those years, this was no easy feat. Yeah also could use the military phone line to connect to the two groups conducting solar science research within the Chinese Academy of Sciences and obtain their observation data by fax. After half a year of study, Ya saw no glimpse of hope. She quickly discovered that within the frequency ranges monitored by Red Coast, solar radiation fluctuated unpredictably. By analyzing large amounts of observed data, Ya discovered a puzzling mystery. Sometimes, during one of the sudden fluctuations in solar radiation, the surface of the sun was calm. Since hundreds of thousands of kilometers of solar material would absorb any shortwave and microwave radiation originating from the core of the sun, the radiation must have come from activities on its surface. So there should have been observable surface activity when these fluctuations occurred. If there were no corresponding surface disturbances, what caused these sudden changes to the narrow frequency ranges? The more she thought about it, the more mysterious it seemed. Eventually, Ya ran out of ideas and decided to give up. In her last report, she conceded that she could not solve the problem. This shouldn't have been a big deal. The military had asked several groups within universities and the Chinese Academy of Sciences to research the same issue, and all of those efforts had failed. But Yang wanted to try one more time, relying on Ya's extraordinary talent. Lei's agenda was even simpler. He just wanted Ya's paper. The research topic was highly theoretical and would show off his expertise and skill. Now that the chaos in society was finally subsiding, the demands on cadres were also changing. There was an acute need for men like him, politically mature and academically accomplished. Of course, he would have a bright future. As to whether the problem of interference from solar outages could be solved, he didn't really care. But in the end, Ya didn't hand in her report. She thought that if the research project were terminated, the base library would stop receiving foreign language journals and other research materials, and she would no longer have access to such a rich trove of astrophysics references. So she nominally continued her research, while in reality she focused on refining her mathematical model of the sun. One night, Ya was, as usual, the only person in the cold reading room of the base library. On the long table in front of her, a pile of documents and journals were spread open. After completing a set of tedious and cumbersome matrix calculations, she blew on her hands to warm them and picked up the latest issue of the Journal of Astrophysics to take a break. As she flipped through it, a brief note about Jupiter caught her attention. Last issue, in A New, Powerful Radiation Source Within the Solar System, Dr. Harry Peterson of Mount Wilson Observatory published a set of data accidentally obtained while observing Jupiter's precession on June 12th and July 2nd, during which strong electromagnetic radiation was detected, lasting 81 seconds and 76 seconds, respectively. The data included the frequency ranges of the radiation as well as other parameters. During the radio outbursts, Peterson also observed certain changes in the Great Red Spot. This discovery drew a lot of interest from planetary scientists. In this issue, G. McKenzie's article argues that it was a sign of fusion starting within Jupiter's core. In the next issue, we will publish Shinoe Kumoseki's article, which attributes the Jovian radio outbursts to a more complicated mechanism, the movements of internal metallic hydrogen plates, and gives a complete mathematical description. Yeah, clearly remembered the two dates noted in the paper. During those windows, the Red Coast monitoring system had also received strong interference from solar outages. She checked the operations diary and confirmed her memory. The times were close, but the solar outages had occurred 16 minutes and 42 seconds after the arrival of the Jovian radio outbursts on Earth. The 16 minutes and 42 seconds are critical. Ya tried to calm her wild heartbeat and asked the librarian to contact the National Observatory to obtain the ephemeris of the Earth's and Jupiter's positions during those two time periods. She drew a big triangle on the blackboard with the Sun, the Earth, and Jupiter at the vertices. She marked the distances along the three edges and wrote down the two arrival times next to the Earth. From the distance between the Earth and Jupiter, it was easy to figure out the time it took for the radio outbursts to travel between the two. Then she calculated the time it would take the radio outbursts to go from Jupiter to the Sun, and then from the Sun to the Earth. The difference between the two was exactly 16 minutes and 42 seconds. Yeah referred to her solar structure mathematical model and tried to find a theoretical explanation. Her eyes were drawn to her description of what she called energy mirrors within the solar radiation zone. Energy produced by reaction within the solar core is initially in the form of high-energy gamma rays. The radiation zone, the region of the sun's interior that surrounds the core, absorbs these high-energy photons and re-emits them at a slightly lower energy level. After a long period of successive absorption and re-emission, a photon might take 1,000 years to leave the sun, gamma rays become X-rays, extreme, ultraviolet, then, eventually, turn into visible light and other forms of radiation. Such were the known facts about the sun. But Yaz's model led to a new result. As solar radiation dropped through these different frequencies on its way through the radiation zone, there were boundaries between the subzones for each type of radiation. As energy crossed each boundary, the radiation frequency stepped down a grade sharply. This was different from the traditional view that the radiation frequency lowered gradually as energy passed from the core outwards. Her calculations showed that these boundaries would reflect radiation coming from the lower frequency side, which was why she named the boundaries energy mirrors. Yeah had carefully studied these membrane-like boundary surfaces suspended in the high-energy plasma ocean of the sun and discovered them to be full of wonderful properties. One of the most incredible characteristics she named gain reflectivity. However, the characteristic was so bizarre that it was hard to confirm, and even Yaa herself didn't quite believe it was real. It seemed more likely an artifact of some error in the dizzying complex calculations. But now Yaa made the first step in confirming her guess about the gain reflectivity of solar energy mirrors. The energy mirrors not only reflected radiation coming from the lower frequency side, but amplified it. All the mysterious sudden fluctuations within narrow frequency bands that she had observed were in fact the result of other radiation coming from space being amplified after reflecting off an energy mirror in the sun. That was why there were no observable disturbances on the surface of the sun. This time, after the Jovian radio outbursts reached the sun, they were re-emitted, as if by a mirror, after being amplified about 100 million times. The Earth received both sets of emissions, before and after the amplification, separated by 16 minutes and 42 seconds. The sun was an amplifier for radio waves. However, there was a question. The sun must be receiving electromagnetic radiation from space every second, including radio waves emitted by the Earth. Why were only some of the waves amplified? The answer was simple. In addition to the selectivity of the energy mirrors for frequencies they would reflect, the main reason was the shielding effect of the solar convection zone. The endlessly boiling convection zone, situated outside the radiation zone, was the outermost liquid layer of the sun. The radio waves coming from space must first penetrate the convection zone to reach the energy mirrors in the radiation zone, where they would be amplified and reflected back out. This meant that in order to reach the energy mirrors, the waves would have to be more powerful than a threshold value. The vast majority of Earth-based radio sources could not cross this threshold, but the Jovian radio outburst did. And Red Coast's maximum transmission power also exceeded the threshold. The problem with solar outages was not resolved, but another exciting possibility presented itself. Humans could use the sun as a super antenna, and, through it, broadcast radio waves to the universe. The radio waves would be sent with the power of the sun, hundreds of millions of times greater than the total usable transmission power on Earth. Earth civilization had a way to transmit at the level of a Kardashev Type II civilization. The next step was to compare the waveforms of the two Jovian radio outbursts with the waveforms of the solar outages received by Red Coast. If they matched, then her guests would receive further confirmation. Yeah made a request to the base leadership to contact Harry Peterson and obtain the waveform records of the two Jovian radio outbursts. This was not easy. It was difficult to find the right communication channels, and numerous bureaucracies required layers of formal paperwork. Any error could lead to her being suspected of acting as a foreign spy. So, Yeah had to wait. But there was a more direct way to prove the hypothesis. Red Coast itself could transmit radio waves directly at the sun at a power level exceeding the threshold value. Yeah again made a request to the base leadership, but she didn't dare to give her real reason. It was too fantastic, and she would have been turned down for certain. Instead, she explained that she wanted to do an experiment for her solar research. The Red Coast transmission system would be used as a solar exploration radar, whose echoes could be analyzed to obtain some information about solar radiation. Lei and Yang both had deep technical backgrounds and wouldn't have been easily fooled, but the experiment described by Yat did have real precedence in Western solar research. In fact, her suggestion was technically easier than the radar exploration of terrestrial planets already being conducted.
Yeah, Wincia, you're getting out of line, said Commissar Lei. Your research should be focused on theory. Do we really need to go to so much trouble?
Yeah begged.
Commissar, it's possible that a big discovery will be made. Experiments are absolutely necessary. I just want to try it once, please.
Chief Yang said,
Commissar Lei, maybe we should try once. It doesn't seem to be too difficult operationally. Receiving the echoes after transmission would take
10-15 minutes, Lei said.
Then Red Coast has just enough time to switch from transmission mode to monitoring mode.
Lei shook his head again.
I know that it's technically and operationally feasible, but you, Chief Yang, you just lack the sensitivity for this kind of thing. You want to aim a super-powerful radio beam at the Red Sun. Have you thought about the political symbolism of such an experiment?
Yang and Ye were both utterly stunned, but they did not think Lei's objection ridiculous. Just the opposite. They were horrified that they themselves had not thought of it. During those years, finding political symbolism in everything had reached absurd levels. The research reports Ye turned in had to be carefully reviewed by Lei so that even technical terms related to the sun could be reportedly revised to remove political risk. Terms like sunspots were forbidden. An experiment that sent a powerful radio transmission at the sun could, of course, be interpreted in 1,000 positive ways, but a single negative interpretation would be enough to bring political disaster on everyone. Lei's reason for refusing to allow the experiment was truly unassailable. Ye didn't give up, though. In fact, as long as she didn't take excessive risk, it wasn't difficult to accomplish her goal. The Red Coast transmitter was ultra-high-powered, but all of its components were domestically produced during the Cultural Revolution. As the quality of the components was not up to par, the fault rate was very high. After every 15th transmission, the entire system had to be overhauled, and after each overhaul, there would be a test transmission. Few people attended these tests, and the targets and other parameters were arbitrarily selected. One time, when she was on duty, Ye was assigned to work during one of the test transmissions after an overhaul. Because a test transmission omitted many operational steps, only Ye and 5 others were present. 3 of them were low-level operators who knew little about the principles behind the equipment. The remaining 2 were a technician and an engineer, both exhausted and not paying much attention after 2 days of overhaul work. Yeah first adjusted the test transmission power to exceed the threshold value for her gain-reflective solar energy mirror theory, using the maximum power of the Red Coast transmission system. Then she set the frequency to the value most likely to be amplified by the energy mirror. and under the guise of testing the antenna's mechanical components, she aimed it at the setting sun in the west. The content of the transmission remained the same as usual. This was a clear afternoon in the autumn of 1971. Afterwards, Yao recalled the event many times, but couldn't remember any special feelings, except anxiety, a desire for the transmission to be completed quickly. First, she was afraid to be discovered by her colleagues. Even though she had thought of some excuses, it was still unusual to use maximum power for a test transmission, because doing so would wear down the components. In addition, the Red Coast transmission system's positioning equipment was never designed to be aimed at the sun. Yeah, could feel the eyepiece growing hot. If it burned out, she would be in real trouble. As the sun set slowly in the west, Yeah had to manually track it. The Red Coast antenna seemed like a giant sunflower at that moment, slowly turning to follow the descending sun. By the time the red light indicating transmission completion lit up, she was already soaked in sweat. She glanced around. The three operators at the control panel were shutting down the equipment piece by piece, in accordance with the instructions in the operating manual. The engineer was drinking a glass of water in a corner of the control room, and the technician was asleep in his chair. No matter how historians and writers later tried to portray the scene, the reality at the time was completely prosaic. The transmission completed, Yao rushed out of the control room and dashed into Yang Weining's office. Catching her breath, she said,
"Tell the base station to begin monitoring the 12,000 megahertz channel."
"What are we receiving?" Chief Yang looked in surprise at Yeah, strands of hair stuck to her sweaty face. Compared to the highly sensitive Red Coast monitoring system, the conventional military-grade radio, normally used by the base for communicating with the outside, was only a toy.
"Maybe we'll get something. There's no time to change the Red Coast system to monitoring mode."
Normally, warming up and switching over to the monitoring system required a little more than 10 minutes, but right now the monitoring system was also being overhauled. Many modules had been taken apart and remained unassembled, rendering them inoperable in the short term. Yang stared at Yeah for a few seconds, and then picked up the phone and ordered the communications office to follow Yeah's direction.
"Given the low sensitivity of that radio, we can probably only receive signals from extraterrestrials on the moon."
"The signal comes from the sun,"
Yeah said. Outside the window, the sun's edge was already approaching the mountains on the horizon, red as blood.
"You used Red Coast to send a signal to the sun?"
Yang asked anxiously. Yeah nodded.
"Don't tell anyone else. This must never happen again. Never!"
Yang looked behind him to be sure there was no one at the door. Yeah nodded again.
"What's the point? The echo wave must be extremely weak, far outside the sensitivity of a conventional radio."
"No. If my guess is right, we should get an extremely strong echo. It'll be more powerful than I can hardly imagine. As long as the transmission power exceeds a certain threshold, the sun can amplify the signal 100 million-fold.
Yang looked at Yeah strangely. Yeah said nothing. They both waited in silence. Yang could clearly hear Yeah's breath and heartbeat. He hadn't paid much attention to what she had said, but the feelings he had buried in his heart for many years resurfaced. He could only restrain himself, waiting. 20 minutes later, Yang picked up the phone, called the communications office, and asked a few simple questions. He put the phone down.
"They received nothing."
Yeah let out a long-held breath and eventually nodded.
"That American astronomer responded, though."
Yang took out a thick envelope covered with customs stamps and handed it to Yeah. She tore the envelope open and scanned Harry Peterson's letter. The letter said that he had not imagined that there would be colleagues in China studying planetary electromagnetism, and that he wished to collaborate and exchange more information in the future. He had also sent 2 stacks of paper, the complete record of the waveforms of the radio outbursts from Jupiter. They were clearly photocopied from the long signal recording tape and would have to be pieced together. Yeah took the dozens of sheets of photocopier paper and started lining them up in two columns on the floor. Halfway through the effort, she gave up any hope. She was very familiar with the waveforms of the interference from the two solar outages. They didn't match these two. Yeah slowly picked up the photocopies from the floor. Yang crouched down to help her. When he handed the stack of paper to this woman he loved with all his heart, he saw her smile. The smile was so sad that his heart trembled.
"What's wrong?"
he asked, not realizing that he had never spoken to her so softly.
"Nothing. I'm just waking up from a dream."
Yeah smiled again. She took the stack of photocopies and the envelope and left the office. She went back to her room, picked up her lunchbox, and went to the cafeteria. Only manteau buns and pickles were left, and the cafeteria workers told her impatiently that they were closing. So she had no choice but to carry her lunchbox outside and walk next to the lip of the cliff, where she sat down on the grass to chew the cold manteau. The sun had already set. The greater Qing'an Mountains were gray and indistinct, just like Ya's life. In this gray life, a dream appeared especially colorful and bright. But one always awoke from a dream, just like the sun, which, though it would rise again, brought no fresh hope. In that moment, Ya saw the rest of her life suffused with an endless grayness. With tears in her eyes, she smiled again and continued to chew the cold manteau. Ya didn't know that at that moment, the first cry that could be heard in space from civilization on Earth was already spreading out from the sun to the universe at the speed of light. A star-powered radio wave, like a majestic tide, had already crossed the orbit of Jupiter. Right then, at the frequency of 12,000 megahertz, the sun was the brightest star in the entire Milky Way. 23. Red Coast 6. The next 8 years were among the most peaceful of Ya Wenxia's life. The horror experienced during the Cultural Revolution gradually subsided, and she was finally able to relax a little. The Red Coast Project completed its testing and breaking in phases, settling down into routine operation. Fewer and fewer technical problems remained, and both work and life became regular. In peace, what had been suppressed by anxiety and fear began to reawaken. Ya found that the real pain had just begun. Nightmarish memories, like embers coming back to life, burn more and more fiercely, searing her heart. For most people, perhaps time would have gradually healed these wounds. After all, during the Cultural Revolution, many people suffered fates similar to hers, and compared to many of them, Ya was relatively fortunate. But Ya had the mental habits of a scientist, and she refused to forget. Rather, she looked with a rational gaze on the madness and hatred that had harmed her. Ya's rational consideration of humanity's evil side began the day she read Silent Spring. As she grew closer to Yan Weining, he was able to get her many classics of foreign language philosophy and history under the guise of gathering technical research materials. The bloody history of humanity shocked her, and the extraordinary insights of the philosophers also led her to understand the most fundamental and secret aspects of human nature. Indeed, even on top of Radar Peak, a place the world almost forgot, the madness and irrationality of the human race were constantly on display. Ya saw that the forest below the peak continued to fall to the deranged logging by her former comrades. Patches of bare earth grew daily, as though those parts of the greater Qing'an Mountains had had their skin torn off. When those patches grew into regions and then into a connected whole, the few surviving trees seemed rather abnormal. To complete the slash-and-burn plan, fires were lit on the bare fields, and Radar Peak became the refuge for birds escaping the fiery inferno. As the fires raged, the sorrowful cries of birds with singed feathers at the base never ceased. The insanity of the human race had reached its historical zenith. The Cold War was at its height. Nuclear missiles, capable of destroying the Earth 10 times over, could be launched at a moment's notice, spread out among the countless missile silos dotting 2 continents, and hidden within ghost-like nuclear-powered ballistic missile submarines patrolling deep under the sea. A single Lafayette or Yankee-class submarine held enough warheads to destroy hundreds of cities and kill hundreds of millions. But most people continued their lives as if nothing was wrong. As an astrophysicist, Yao was strongly against nuclear weapons. She knew this was a power that should belong only to the stars. She knew also that the universe had even more terrible forces: black holes, antimatter, and more. Compared to those forces, a thermonuclear bomb was nothing but a tiny candle. If humans obtained mastery over one of those other forces, the world might be vaporized in a moment. In the face of madness, rationality was powerless. 4 years after entering Red Coast Base, Ya and Yang married. Yang truly loved her. For love, he gave up his future. The fiercest stage of the Cultural Revolution was over, and the political climate had grown somewhat milder. Yang wasn't persecuted exactly for his marriage. However, because he married a woman who had been deemed to be a counter-revolutionary, he was viewed as politically immature and lost his position as chief engineer. The only reason that he and his wife were allowed to stay on the base as ordinary technicians was because the base could not do without their technical skills. Ya accepted Yang's proposal mainly out of gratitude. If he hadn't brought her into this safe haven in her most perilous moment, she would probably no longer be alive. Yang was a talented man, cultured and with good taste. She didn't find him unpleasant, but her heart was like ashes from which the flame of love could no longer be lit. As she pondered human nature, Ya was faced with an ultimate loss of purpose and sank into another spiritual crisis. She had once been an idealist who needed to give all her talent to a great goal, but now she realized that all she had done was meaningless, and the future could not have any meaningful pursuits either. As this mental state persisted, she gradually felt more and more alienated from the world. She didn't belong. The sense of wandering in the spiritual wilderness tormented her. After she made a home with Yang, her soul became homeless. One night, Ya was working the night shift. This was the loneliest time. In the deep silence of midnight, the universe revealed itself to its listeners as a vast desolation. What Ya disliked most was seeing the waves that slowly crawled across the display, a visual record of the meaningless noise Red Coast picked up from space. Ya felt this interminable wave was an abstract view of the universe, one end connected to the endless past, the other to the endless future, and in the middle, only the ups and downs of random chance. Without life, without pattern, the peaks and valleys at different heights like uneven grains of sand, the whole curve like a one-dimensional desert made of all the grains of sand lined up in a row, lonely, desolate, so long that it was intolerable. You could follow it and go forward or backward as long as you liked, but you'd never find the end. On this day, however, Ya saw something odd when she glanced at the waveform display. Even experts had a hard time telling with the naked eye whether a waveform carried information. But Ya was so familiar with the noise of the universe that she could tell that the wave that now moved in front of her eyes had something extra. The thin curve, rising and falling, seemed to possess a soul. She was certain that the radio signal before had been modulated by intelligence. She rushed to another terminal and checked the computer's rating of the signal's recognizability. A-A-A-A-A. Before this, no radio signal received by Red Coast ever garnered a recognizability rating above C. An A rating meant the likelihood that the transmission contained intelligent information was greater than 90%. A rating of A-A-A-A-A was a special, extreme case. It meant the received transmission used the exact same coding language as Red Coast's own outbound transmission. Yeah turned on the Red Coast deciphering system. The software attempted to decipher any signal whose recognizability rating was above B. During the entire time that the Red Coast project had been running, it had never been invoked even once in real use. Based on test data, deciphering a transmission suspected of being a message might require a few days or even a few months of computing time, and the result would be failure more than half the time. But this time, as soon as the file containing the original transmission was submitted, the display showed that the deciphering was complete. Yeah opened the resulting document, and for the first time, a human read a message from another world. The content was not what anyone had imagined. It was a warning, repeated three times. Do not answer. Do not answer. Do not answer. Still caught up by the dizzying excitement and confusion, Yeah deciphered a second message. This world has received your message. I am a pacifist in this world. It is the luck of your civilization that I am the first to receive your message. I am warning you. Do not answer. Do not answer. Do not answer. There are tens of millions of stars in your direction. As long as you do not answer, this world will not be able to ascertain the source of your transmission. But if you do answer, the source will be located right away. Your planet will be invaded. Your world will be conquered. Do not answer. Do not answer. Do not answer. As she read the flashing green text on the display, Yao was no longer capable of thinking clearly. Her mind, inhibited by shock and excitement, could only understand this. No more than 9 years had passed since the time she had sent the message to the sun. Then the source of this transmission must be around 4 light-years away. It could only have come from the closest extrasolar stellar system, Alpha Centauri. The universe was not desolate. The universe was not empty. The universe was full of life. Humankind had cast their gaze to the end of the universe, but they had no idea that intelligent life already existed around the stars closest to them. Yeah stared at the waveform display. The signal continued to stream from the universe into the Red Coast antenna. She opened up another interface and began real-time deciphering. The messages began to show up immediately on the screen. During the next 4 hours, Yeah learned of the existence of Trisolaris, learned of the civilization that had been reborn again and again, and learned of their plan to migrate to the stars. At 4 in the morning, the transmission from Alpha Centauri ended. The deciphering system continued to run uselessly and emitted an unceasing string of failure codes. The Red Coast monitoring system was once again only hearing the noise of the universe. But Yeah was certain that what she had just experienced was not a dream. The sun really was an amplifying antenna. But why had her experiment 8 years ago not received any echoes? Why had the waveforms of Jupiter's radio outbursts not matched the later radiation from the sun? Later, Yeah came up with many reasons. It was possible that the base communication office couldn't receive radio waves at that frequency. Or maybe the office did receive the echo, but it sounded like noise, and so the operator thought it was nothing. As for the waveforms, it was possible that when the sun amplified the radio waves, it also added another wave to it. It would likely be a periodic wave that could be easily filtered out by the alien deciphering system. But to her unaided eye, the waveform from Jupiter and from the sun would appear very different. Years later, after Yeh had left Red Coast, she would manage to confirm her last guess. The sun had added a sine wave. She looked around alertly. There were 3 others in the main computer room. 2 of the 3 were chatting in a corner, while the last was napping before a terminal. In the data analysis section of the monitoring system, only the 2 terminals in front of her could view the recognizability rating of a signal and access the deciphering system. Maintaining her composure, she worked quickly and moved all of the received messages to a multiply encrypted, invisible subdirectory. Then she copied over a segment of noise received a year ago as a substitute for the transmission received during the last 5 hours. Finally, from the terminal, she placed a short message into the Red Coast's transmission buffer. Yeah got up and left the monitoring main control room. A chilly wind blew against her feverish face. Dawn had just brightened the eastern sky, and she followed the dimly lit, pebble-paved path to the transmission main control room. Above her, the Red Coast antenna lay open, silently, like a giant palm toward the universe. The Dawn turned the guard at the door into a silhouette, and as usual, he did not pay attention to Yeah as she entered. The transmission main control room was much dimmer than the monitoring main control room. Yeah passed through rows of cabinets to stand in front of the control panel and flip more than a dozen switches with practiced ease to warm up the transmission system. The two men on duty next to the control panel looked up at her with sleepy eyes, and one turned to glance at the clock. Then one of them went back to his nap, while the other flipped through a well-thumbed newspaper. At the base, Yeah had no political status, but she did have some freedom in technical matters. She often tested the equipment before a transmission. Although she was early today, the transmission wasn't scheduled to occur until 3 hours later. Warming up a bit early wasn't that unusual. What happened next was the longest half hour of her life. During this time, Yeah adjusted the transmission frequency to the optimal frequency for amplification by the solar energy mirror and increased the transmission power to maximum. Then, putting her eyes to the eyepiece of the optical positioning system, she watched the sun rise above the horizon, activated the positioning system for the antenna, and slowly aligned it with the sun. As the gigantic antenna turned, the rumbling noise shook the main control room. One of the men on duty looked at Yeah again, but said nothing. The sun was now completely above the horizon. The crosshair of the Red Coast positioning system was aimed at its upper edge to account for the time it would take for the radio wave to travel to the sun. The transmission system was ready. The transmit button was a long rectangle, very similar to the space key on a computer keyboard, except that it was red. Yaz's hand hovered 2 centimeters above it. The fate of the entire human race was now tied to these slender fingers. Without hesitation, Yeah pressed the button.
"What are you doing?"
one of the men on duty asked, still sleepy. Yeah smiled at him and said nothing. She pressed a yellow button to stop the transmission. Then she moved the control stick until the antenna was pointed elsewhere. She left the control panel and walked away. The man looked at his watch. It was time to get off work. He picked up the diary and thought about recording Yaz's operation of the transmission system. It was, after all, out of the ordinary. But then he looked at the paper tape and saw that she had transmitted for no more than 3 seconds. He tossed the diary back, yawned, put on his army cap, and left. The message that was winging its way to the sun said, "Come here. I will help you conquer this world. Our civilization is no longer capable of solving its own problems. We need your force to intervene." The newly risen sun dazzled Yeah Wenxia. Not too far from the door of the main control room, she collapsed onto the lawn in a faint. When she woke up, she found herself in the base clinic. Next to her bed sat Yang, watching her with concern. Like that time many years ago on the helicopter. The doctor told Yeah to be careful and get plenty of rest.
"You are pregnant," he said.
24. Rebellion. After Yeah Wenxia finished recounting the history of her first contact with Tri-Solaris, the abandoned cafeteria remained silent. Many present were apparently just hearing the complete story for the first time. Wong was deeply absorbed by the narrative and temporarily forgot about the danger and terror he faced. Unable to stop himself, he asked,
"How did the ETO then develop to its present scale?"
Yeah replied,
"I'd have to start with how I got to know Evans. But every comrade here already knows that part of history, so we shouldn't waste time on it now. I can tell you later. However, whether we'll have such an opportunity depends on you. Xiao Wong, let's talk about your nanomaterial. This lord that you talk about, why is it so afraid of nanomaterial?"
"Because it can allow humans to escape gravity and engage in space construction at a much larger scale."
"The space elevator?"
Wong suddenly understood.
"Yes. If ultra-strong nanomaterials could be mass-produced, then that would lay the technical foundation for building a space elevator from the ground up to a geostationary point in space. For our Lord, this is but a tiny invention. But for humans on Earth, its meaning would be significant. With this technology, humans could easily enter near-Earth space and build up large-scale defensive structures. Thus, this technology must be extinguished."
"What is at the end of the countdown?"
Wong asked the question that frightened him the most. Yeah smiled.
"I don't know."
"But trying to stop me is useless. This is not basic research. Based on what we've already found out, someone else can figure out the rest."
Wong's voice was loud but anxious.
"Yes, it is rather useless. It's far more effective to confuse the researchers' minds. But, like you point out, we didn't stop the progress in time. After all, what you do is applied research. Our technique is far more effective against basic research."
"Speaking of basic research, how did your daughter die?"
The question silenced Yeah for a few seconds. Wong noticed that her eyes dimmed almost imperceptibly, but she then resumed the conversation.
"Indeed, compared to our Lord, who possesses peerless strength, everything we do is meaningless. We're just doing whatever we can."
Just as she finished speaking, several loud booms rang out, and the doors to the cafeteria broke open. A team of soldiers holding submachine guns rushed in. Wong realized that they were not armed police, but the real army. Noiselessly, they proceeded along the walls and soon surrounded the rebels of the ETO. Shutyong was the last to enter. His jacket was open, and he held the barrel of a pistol so that the grip was like the head of a hammer. Dasha looked around arrogantly, then suddenly dashed forward. His hand flashed, and there was the dull thud of metal striking against a skull. An ETO rebel fell to the ground, and the gun that he was trying to draw tumbled to fall some distance away. Several soldiers began to shoot at the ceiling, and dust and debris fell. Someone grabbed Wong Miao and pulled him away from the ETO ranks until he was safe behind a row of soldiers.
"Drop all your weapons onto the table. I swear I'm gonna kill the next son of a bitch who tries anything."
Dasha pointed at the submachine guns arrayed behind him.
"I know that none of you is afraid to die, but we're not afraid either. I'm gonna say this up front. Normal police procedures and laws don't apply to you. Even the human laws of warfare no longer apply to you, since you've decided to treat the entire human race as your enemy. There's no longer anything we wouldn't do to you."
There was some commotion among the ETO members, but no one panicked. Yaz's face remained impassive. Three people suddenly rushed out of the crowd, including the young woman who had twisted Pan Han's neck. They ran toward the three-body sculpture, and each grabbed one of the spheres and held it in front of his or her chest. The young woman raised the bright metal sphere before her with both hands, as though she were getting ready to start a gymnastics routine. Smiling, she said,
"Officers, we hold in our hands 3 nuclear bombs, each with a yield of about 1.5 kilotons. Not too big, since we like small toys. This is the detonator."
Everyone in the cafeteria froze. The only one who moved was Xia Qiang. He put his gun back into the holster under his left arm and placed his hands together calmly.
"Our demand is simple. Let the commander go,"
the young woman said.
"Then we can play whatever game you want."
Her tone suggested that she wasn't afraid of Xia Qiang and the soldiers at all.
"I stay with my comrades,"
Ya said calmly.
"Can you confirm her claim?"
Da Xia asked an officer next to him, an explosives expert. The officer threw a bag in front of the 3 ETO members holding the spheres. One of the ETO fighters picked up the bag and took out a spring scale, a bigger version of the one some customers brought to street markets to verify the portions measured by vendors. He placed his metal sphere into the bag, attached it to the spring scale, and held it aloft. The gauge extended about halfway and stopped. The young woman chuckled. The explosives expert also laughed, contemptuously. The ETO member took out the sphere and tossed it on the ground. Another ETO fighter picked up the scale and the bag and repeated the procedure with his sphere, and ended up also tossing the sphere to the ground. The young woman laughed once more and picked up the bag herself. She loaded her sphere into the bag, hung it on the hook of the scale, and the gauge immediately dropped to its bottom, the spring in the scale having been fully extended. The smile on the explosives expert's face froze. He whispered to Da Xia,
"Damn, they really do have one."
Da Xia remained impassive. The explosives expert said,
"We can at least confirm that there are heavy elements, fissile material inside. We don't know if the detonation mechanism works."
The flashlights attached to the soldiers' guns focused on the young woman holding the nuclear bomb. While she held the destructive power of 1.5 kilotons of TNT in her hands, she smiled brightly, as though enjoying applause and praise on a spotlit stage.
"I have an idea. Shoot the sphere,"
the explosives expert whispered to Da Xia.
"Won't that set off the bomb?"
"The conventional explosives around the outside will go off, but the explosion will be scattered. It won't lead to the kind of precise compression of the fissile material in the center necessary for a nuclear explosion."
Da Xia stared at the nuclear woman, saying nothing.
"How about snipers?"
Almost imperceptibly, Da Xia shook his head.
"Well, there's no good position. She's sharp as a tack. As soon as she's targeted by a sniper scope, she'll know."
Da Xia strode forward. He pushed the crowd apart and stood in the middle of the empty space.
"Stop!"
The young woman warned Da Xia, staring at him intently. Her right thumb was poised over the detonator. Her face was no longer smiling in the flashlight beams.
"Calm down,"
Da Xia said, standing about 7 or 8 meters from her. He took an envelope from his pocket.
"I have some information you'll definitely want to know. Your mother has been found."
The young woman's feverish eyes dimmed. At that moment, her eyes were truly windows to her soul. Da Xia took 2 steps forward. He was now no more than 5 meters from her. She raised the bomb and warned him with her eyes, but she was already distracted. One of the 2 ETO members who had tossed away fake bombs strode toward Da Xia to take the envelope from him. As the man blocked the woman's view of Da Xia, he drew his gun with a lightning-fast motion. The woman only saw a flash by the ear of the man trying to take the letter from Da Xia before the bomb in her hands exploded. After hearing the muffled explosion, Wong saw nothing before his eyes but darkness. Someone dragged him out of the cafeteria. Thick yellow smoke poured out of the door, and a cacophony of shouting and gunshots came from inside. From time to time, people rushed through the smoke and out of the cafeteria. Wong got up and tried to go back into the cafeteria, but the explosives expert grabbed him around the waist and stopped him.
Careful! Radiation!
The chaos eventually subsided. More than a dozen ETO fighters were killed in the gunfight. The rest, more than 200, including Yao Wenxia, were arrested. The explosion had turned the nuclear woman into a bloody mess, but she was the only casualty of the aborted bomb. The man who had tried to take the letter from Da Shu was severely injured, but since his body had shielded Da Shu, his wounds were light. However, like everyone else who remained in the cafeteria after the explosion, Shu suffered severe radiation contamination. Through the small window of an ambulance, Wong stared at Da Shu, who was lying inside. A wound on Da Shu's head continued to ooze blood. The nurse who was dressing the wound wore transparent protective gear. Da Shu and Wong could only talk through their mobile phones.
"Who was that young woman's mother?"
Wong asked. Da Shu grinned.
"Fucked if I know. Just a guess. A girl like that most likely has mother issues. After doing this for more than 20 years, I'm pretty good at reading people."
"I bet you're happy to be proven right. There really was someone behind all this."
Wong forced himself to smile, hoping Da Shu could see it.
"Buddy, you're the one who was right."
Da Shu laughed, shaking his head.
"I would never have thought that actual fucking aliens would be involved."
25. The deaths of Lei Zicheng and Yang Weining. Interrogator.
Name?
Yao Wenxia.
Yao Wenxia.
Interrogator.
Birthday.
Yeah.
June 1943.
Interrogator.
Employment?
Yeah.
Professor of Astrophysics at Tsinghua University. Retired in 2004.
In consideration of your health, you may stop the interrogation temporarily at any time.
Thank you. I'm fine.
We're only conducting a regular criminal investigation now, and won't get into more sensitive matters. We would like to finish quickly. We hope you'll cooperate.
I know what you're referring to. Yes, I'll cooperate.
Our investigation revealed that while you were working at Red Coast Base, you were suspected of murder.
I did kill two people.
When?
The afternoon of October 21st, 1979.
Names of the victims?
Base Commissar Lei Zicheng and my husband, Base Engineer Yang Weining.
Explain your motive for murder.
Can I assume that you understand the relevant background?
I know the basics. If something is unclear, I'll ask you.
Good. On the day when I received the extraterrestrial communication and replied, I learned that I wasn't the only one to get the message. Lei did as well. Lei was a typical political cadre of the time, so he possessed an extremely keen sense for politics and saw everything through an ideological lens. Unbeknownst to most of the technical staff at Red Coast Base, he ran a small program in the background on the main computer. This program constantly read from the transmission and reception buffers and stored the results in a hidden encrypted file. This way, there would be a copy of everything Red Coast sent and received that only he could read. It was from this copy that he discovered the extraterrestrial message. On the afternoon after I sent my message toward the rising sun, and shortly after I learned that I was pregnant at the base clinic, Lei called me to his office,
and I saw that his terminal displayed the message from Tri-Solaris that I had received the night before.
8 hours have passed since you received the first message. Instead of making a report, you deleted the original message and maybe hid a copy. Isn't that right?
I kept my head down and did not reply.
I know your next move.